Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Oh, there's a mic. I don't actually need a mic. I'm very loud. My name's Kenneth Clark. I'm the director of the Poetry Center. Thank you for coming out tonight, and this is one of more than 400 events the Poetry Center has produced to celebrate poets and poetry. So thanks again for coming. I want a special thanks to the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, who sponsored Gary's reading this evening, and a big thanks to the School of the Art Institute for their long time and long-term support. We've been here since 1982. Tonight, Gary will read from his work, and after, he will sign books. There's also a special limited edition art print, what poets call a broadside, available tonight for a special price in the back. And the art on it is by New Yorker cartoonist Tom Bachtel. In a moment, my friend and colleague, Koresh Ali Lansana, will introduce Gary Soto. Koresh is a professor at Chicago State University, and he is the director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center.
Again, good evening. My name is Koresh Ali Lansana, and I'm director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center at Chicago State University, and I'm very honored to be here this evening to introduce poet, fiction writer, essayist, children's literature author, filmmaker, and social justice worker, Gary Soto. I actually believe there might be an S on his chest. Born and raised in Fresno, California, Gary Soto is the author of 10 poetry collections for adults, most notably New and Selected Poems, a 1995 finalist for both the Los Angeles Times Book Award and the National Book Award. His recollections, Living Up the Street, received a Before Columbus 1985 American Book Award. His poems have appeared in many literary magazines, including The Nation, Plowshares, The Iowa Review, Ontario Review, and most frequently, Poetry, published right here in Chicago, which has honored him with the Best Hoken Prize and the Levinson Award, and by featuring him in Poets in Person. He is one of the youngest poets to appear in the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry. He has received the Discovery the Nation Prize, the U.S. Award of the International Poetry Forum, the California Library Association's John and Patricia Beatty Award twice, a recognition of merit from the Claremont Graduate School for Baseball in April, the Silver Medal from the Commonwealth Club of California, and the Tomas Rivera Prize, in addition to fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, twice. I told you there was an S on his chest, didn't I? And the California Arts Council. For ITVS, he produced the film The Pool Party, which received the 1993 Andrew Carnegie Medal. For the Los Angeles Opera, he wrote the libretto for an opera titled Nerdlandia. In 1999, he received the Literature Award from the Hispanic Heritage Foundation, the Author Illustrator Civil Rights Award and the National Education Association, and the Penn Center West Book Award for Petty Crimes. He serves as Young People's Ambassador for the California Rural Legal Assistance and the United Farm Workers of America, and he lives in Berkeley. I was introduced to Mr. Soto's work almost a decade ago while working as a language arts editor for an educational publishing company. During that seven-year span, I had the pleasure of editing with two other major textbook publishers and the privilege of selecting poems by Mr. Soto, numerous poems by Mr. Soto, to share with our nation's youth. Raymond Pettis from the Rocky Mountain Review eloquently confirmed the reason so many editors value Soto's pen when he wrote, and I quote, "Soto establishes his acute sense of ethnicity and simultaneously his belief that certain emotions, values, and experiences transcend ethnic boundaries and allegiances," end quote. It is this same humanness, this same depth of command, of nuance and tone, and muscular, tender freshness that permeates all his work for young and taller. From Dead, You Can Keep Going. Arturo stomps the heel of his boot and tells me, "Every pinche minute I mess up a red ant." "That's no good," I tell him. me in the young man in the next row, the shadow of my hoe cutting weeds in Boswell's beet field. Arturo says, every super pinche half hour I see this squirrel spin and drop. You know, the chemicals you and me are breathing. That's not nice. I tell him and hold my breath for a long second. I then feel something touch my sleeve. Sunlight where there was dark and the icy thread of stars. We started before dawn as the tainted valley wind nudged us along, and I had no thoughts other than counting my steps. Now morning has peeled its eye open. The poem goes on, and it's a beautiful piece, but I wanted to give you a taste of what you have in store from this giant of a man, and as Gwendolyn Brooks phrased it, a person, a poet who can illuminate the extraordinary in the ordinary. Please welcome Gary Soto.
I'm in Chicago. I can't believe it. How are you? Good to see all of you. I don't know you, but I look forward to knowing you after this reading here. You know, I've never gotten a job through an interview. And every time I've been interviewed, they said, there's the door, go home. And the jobs I've gotten tend to be through friends. The first poem is called Self-Inquiry Before a Job Interview. Did you sneeze? Yes, I rid myself of the imposter inside me. Did you iron your shirt? Yes, I use the steam of mother's hate. Did you wash your hands? Yes, I learned my hygiene from a raccoon. I prayed on my knees, and my knees answered with pain. I gargled. I polished my shoes until I saw who I was. I inflated my resume by employing my middle name. I walked to my interview early, the sun like a ring on an electric stove. I patted my hair when I entered the wind of a revolving door. The guard said, for you, it's the basement. The economy was up. Flags whipped in every city plaza in America. This I saw for myself as I rode the elevator, empty because everyone had a job but me. Did you clean your ears? Yes, not far from the drinking fountain's idiotic drivel. Did you slice a banana in your daily oatmeal? I added a pinch of salt. Two raisins to sweeten my breath. Did you remember your pen? I remembered my fingers, my yawn, as the elevator opened. I shook hands that dripped like a dirty sea. On the third day, I rose to the second floor. I found a chair and desk. My name tag said my name. Through the glass ceiling, I saw the heavy rumps of CEOs struggling to spell tomorrow, one R or two. I sharpened my pencil into the wastebasket, kindling for a fire, and pushed rig contracts into the remarkable teeth of a hungry paper shredder. Just think of some naughty corporations that went under a couple years ago. I live in Berkeley. We have an ordinance that your dog is not a companion. No, not a pet, but a companion. So when you take him to the vet, my companion, not my pet. And this is a spoof on that. It's called Berkeley Dogs. The dogs, well, by the way, let me just preface this. You know, sometimes I'm walking around Berkeley, and I'll see these dogs in these Volvos. They're always in Volvos. I don't know why, Irish setters. And they look at me and go, I ain't a dog. I look like a dog, but I ain't a dog. I said, you're a dog. He said, no, I ain't a dog, man. And so it's kind of like this thing is happening to my brain. I don't know what it is, but the dogs look human in their Volvos, or so I discover as I walk through the parking lot of Long's Drugs, swinging my small purchase of antacids and vanilla ice cream. All the dogs sit in their rightful places, the windows cracked, their mugs convey the look of, no, I'm not what you think. I call hey boy to one pup who turns his head away, disgusted. I call hey lassie to a golden retriever, To make her point, she places her paws onto the steering wheel. These dogs don't bark. Their eyes form the words to say, go away. I don't. When I look in the window of one car, the dog busies itself checking the odometer for the next oil change. How did this happen, this evolution in less than 30 years? The pooches of my childhood street fetched and frolicked, fought themselves into bloody rags. They copulated in a fury as we kids hollered, amazed by the push-push action in the middle of the street. These Berkeley dogs practice their zen with the feng shui of water bowls set half in, half out of shadows. These dogs know how to roll with Aikido. They have lawyers, too, when divorce occurs, and resolution counselors when a fuss rises between different breeds. They know their rights. The moon has no influence on these canines, and the moon now rides high over the parking lot of Long's Drugs. By this light, I see a dog in every car, parked car reading the Wall Street Journal. I'm still where I always was, a male dog with his Playboys in the bottom drawer. These dogs have shifted from the back seat to the passenger seat to finally the driver's seat. When one set of owners returns from the store, they get in the back. The dog gazes in the rearview mirror to see if his companions are buckled in, for they share in wills and deeds. The Volvo starts with a shiver, leaves cautiously. The companions smile to each other. They take up leashes in their mouths, sniffing for the future.
Okay, this is a poem called The Effects of Abstract Art. The first Chicano artist, Mexican-American artist, actually can be found in Fresno, California. I started in 1949, and his name is Ernie Palomino. Ernie Palomino was a guy that used to run with my uncle, my dad, and a few other locals in Fresno. And when they knew him in junior high and high school, he could actually render really, really fine artwork. You know, you draw a clown and it looked like a clown. Or you draw, you know, a horse and it looked like a horse. And they thought he was very talented. Except then he went to Paris for a season and he discovered, of course, Cubist art. And when he came back, you know, he was doing another kind of art and no one could understand what he was doing. So this is a poem about that. I changed the name to Charlie. Charlie, our one hope, called all the bachucos from Braley Street to line up. Since half had been in road camp, shackled and such, they followed his orders and had their faces drawn in charcoal. These thugs went away smiling at their portraits, and Charlie too went away. 3 months later, he was in Paris. Fresno still damp water behind his ears. He walked on snow and ate bread and cheese. He drank coffee at outdoor cafes, an accordion of homesickness living in his chest. Girls helped, and wine dark as the Middle Ages helped. He studied the art of the time. The river cracked his dull mirror of ice, and suddenly in a heatless room, Charlie was going abstract. The chairs no longer chairs, but buckled wood and juts of timber. He painted a Nazi with a boot for a head and a cathedral leaning in atomic wind. The river thawed from hot human tears. The fish drank that brew and hopped onto dinner plates. This, according to Charlie's suddenly cubist art. Back in Fresno, he showed all the chucos his new art, the crooked lines, the negative space, and every face beautifully out of whack. Man, the chucos couldn't understand it. Charlie drawing so good just a few months before, and now now the eyes of farmers dripping like eggs. Was Charlie a wino, a myopic young man? Had existentialism weakened his blood? My uncle looked over Charlie's fingers. Poor guy, no telling when a train ran them over. Okay, I'm just going to read one after another here. I'm going to play it safe. Okay, I'm a Presbyterian, and I don't know what you are, but I was When I went to the Presbyterian church in Oakland, the Pastor Ramirez asked me to teach English to the congregation. And since I spoke English gooder than most people, I said, all right, I'll do it. And so it was a Presbyterian church. We had a Presbyterian school abandoned, and in the closets I found a bunch of old composition text books. And I said, okay, I'll teach the gente from these things here. And the best way to teach English, or language for that matter, is actually through illustration by demonstration. At least I discovered. And this is a poem called Teaching English from an Old Composition Book. My chalk is no longer than a chip of fingernail, chip which I must explain this Monday night, the verbs to get, to wear, to cut. I'm not given much. These tired students, knuckle-wrapped from work as roofers, tired from scrubbing toilets and pedestal stinks. I'm given this room with five windows, a coffee machine, a piano with busted strings, the music of how we feel as the sun falls, exhausted from keeping up. I stand at the blackboard. The chalk is worn to a hangnail, nearly gone. The dust of some educational bone. By and by, I'm Cantinflas, the comic busybody in front of the class. I say to the class, I get the coffee. I pick up the coffee cup and sip. I click my heels and say, I wear my shoes. I bring an invisible fork to my mouth and say, I eat the chicken. Suddenly, the class is alive. Each one putting on pants and shoes, drinking sodas and beers, cutting flowers and steaks, a pantomime of sumptuous living. At break, I pass out cookies. Augustine the Guatemalan asks in Spanish, Profesor, ¿qué es telijo? I look at the word in the composition book. I raise my face to the bare bowl for a blind answer. I stutter, then say, pues es como adelante. As in go ahead. Augustine smiles, then nudges a friend in the next desk, now smarter by one word. After the cookies are eaten, we move ahead to prepositions, under, over, between, useful words when La Migra opens the doors of their idling vans. At 10 to 9, I'm tired of acting, and they're tired of their roles. When class ends, I clap my hands of chalk dust, and two students applaud, thinking it's a new verb. I tell them, adelante, go ahead, move on. And they pick up their old books. They smile and, in return, cry, tally-ho, as they head for the door. All right, let's see. I read you that one here. I'm a walking miracle. I graduated from high school with a 1.6 GPA. 1970, you do the math to figure out how old I am. If you shave off a couple of years, that would be fine with me. So I started my education off at a community college, Fresno City College, and I went there because it offered ample parking, and that was good enough for me. And I think a lot of writers, poets, we sort of slice up our lives. We try to figure out, well, gee, what next? And so I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Junior College. And I enjoyed my years there, 2 years. And so this is a collection about that. One of the first classes I took was in music appreciation. And I thought, man, people like this stuff? Thinking about, Mozart and the heavy hitters. And I was getting an inflated B in the class. And the teacher said, who wants extra credit? And I said, well, I do. And he said, go hear a classical ensemble and you'll get the extra credit. And this is a poem about that. And it's a poem about early 70s. And I decided to starch my clothes knowing it was going to be an evening that was formal. So I had to be as stiff as possible. So I threw all my clothes in this little galvanized bucket and gave them a little whirl. And they came out and they were hard, all right. I put on my pants and shirt, both ironed, both hard with milky starch, and walked 2 miles to hear a string quartet. I felt brand new in my starched clothes, my legs stuffed in milk cartons, my neck choked by a toilet roll. I sat in the front row and struggled to place a lifesaver on my tongue. I looked around, my head turning awkwardly, stiffly. I recognized others for music appreciation. All of them with scrubbed faces and straight as planks. They, too, had dropped their clothes into a galvanized bucket and snowed the snowy starch under their clothes. When the quartet appeared, also stiff, I clapped like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz just before he rusted, my hands coming together with a slow clap, clap, clap. The quartet saw their instruments back and forth, their tiny arms like the arms of praying mantis. The music itself was slow, but the evening was easy extra credit. I sat tall as a letter A, tears in my eyes, then on my cheeks. My yawns could have pushed the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. 3 times around the world, I was so bored. By the end of the evening, my face was wet and I was out of breath. I used both hands to stand up and clap for the quartet. On the way home, I prepared in my mind the first line of my essay. On a stiff evening of starched clothes, the audience cried with joy. No one cried, "Oh, let this sucker end." I stepped 1 foot over the other, careful not to fall over. I considered these options with leftover tears in my eyes and a wind filling my shirt. Like an almighty sail. And junior college has a deadpan kind of humor to it. So if you're laughing, that's okay. If you're weeping, that's all right too. This is a poem called Pompeii and the Uses of Our Imagination. And my brother was a year ahead of me at City College. He graduated with a 1.8. We were a stellar family. And so he was telling what classes to take. And I said, well, he needed a Western Civ class. And this is, so I took Western Civ. It was really hard. Pompeii and the Uses of Our Imagination. Our history teacher, a Southern fellow, said, close your eyes and think back into time. This was a new way of sleeping in an 8 o'clock class. The sun, a pink scar in our eastern window. He told us about Pompeii, a bad luck city, and how the lava had run over the rich and poor alike. Since I was between a B and an inflated A, I did what I was told. I closed my eyes and imagined a huge tamale run over by mole sauce. My only reference to a thing that ever got smothered. On top of the tamale, there was a chariot, crowned gods, and an emperor in a robe. There was a slave, the slave's bloody axe. There was a Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. I'm sorry, the wrong century. I wiped out this image, returned the flow of lava, jugs of wine, leather sandals, horses. I saw a fountain, oxen, pigs, and for a second, a covered wagon plugged with burning arrows. My history was all mixed up. I closed my eyes tighter and returned the lava, statues crumbling to their knees, and citizens caught in the hot river, their legs in the air. I saw girls run from the fire, soldiers in leather skirts and plumed helmets. And then the covered wagon reappeared with a sprout of more arrows. My God, I scolded myself. What's wrong with you, Gary? The history teacher repeated back into time. I pulled together a harp, a bowl of grapes, figs. And then on the tamale, I placed 2 cavemen, no 3, all with the faces of my favorite actors, Yul Brynner, Tony Curtis, and Kirk Douglas, my heroes from the 60s. They were going to fight the lava, push it back. But they slipped on the mole sauce and slipped away on the lenses of my tears. I had gone too far. I was no good at history. The covered wagon floated behind my closed eyes, then an astronaut, then George C. Scott. Man, I couldn't think right. A fork rose and fell on that tamale, the steam uncurling, not unlike Pompeii when the land cooled, waves crashed, dogs sniffed the ruins, and, oh my God, my error once again, the covered wagon with Moses and Charleston Heston struggling for the reins. Now, some people don't know, well, who's Charleston Heston or Kirk Douglas? Well, they're the sort of the Johnny Depp of that time, you know. Okay, anyone go to a community college, start their education? Oh, very good. So some of us, I like my 2 years there. You had friends, you fell in love, out of love, and things like that. One more poem from from junior college. I may come back to it later. This is a poem. Where in the world is it? Oh, the Skeptics. We'll read the Skeptics here. And so my brother and I, the one with the 1.8, you know, we were getting smart. Education has its merits. And after Western Civ, I began to sort of name drop some of the great philosophers of the world, having no idea what they're really about, but they sounded pretty cool. I got the name Gary, even though our family's truly Mexican-American, Chicano, low class from Fresno. I got it from Gary Cooper. So there's a lot of Garys in Gary Padilla, Gary Mejia, Gary, who's another Gary, Perez. So there's a whole group of us from the 50s. I don't know why, you know. I always wanted the name Demetrius. That's a killer name, you know. It's like a name that people are going to say, well, you can't mess with Demetrius, man. So in this poem, it's called The Skeptics. I'm either Pyro or Sextus Empiricus. Here's how the poem goes. Pyro of Elis and Sextus Empiricus were skeptics, two big-shot thinkers who argued over figs, wine, and the loveliness of their bodies. I crowed to my brother about them, and one evening with fig Newtons in our mouths, I was Pyro and Rick was Sextus, both of us skeptical about getting good jobs. I said, "Brother Sextus, what will you render on the canvas when you're all grown up?" He was an artist. He chewed on his fig Newton and answered, "Pyro, my young flame, I will draw the reality of dead dogs with their feet straight in the air." I crowed, "Wow, Rick, Sextus, that's awesome." In sandals, we went down to the liquor store, each of us in our imaginary Greek robes, and stole a quart of beer. And neither of us was skeptic when we swigged on that quart of beer and walked past our house where a woman hammered on walnuts, the rise and fall of her buttery hand quivering the two hairs on my chest. We ate figs and wine, and what we skeptics needed was three strokes of that hammering. I flowed over in my robe and said, "We're brother skeptics, ruled by cautious truth." She smiled, hammer raised, and said, "Sure you are." Right away, we got along, a womanly skeptic with a nice swing. I sat on the steps, a young man with figs, his wine, and with my Greek name shed, reverent believer in a woman with a hammer in hand. One more poem from junior college. This was, of course, the writer's mind. Someone asked me, "Why didn't you go into math?" Because I was no good at math. And I really feared sciences in college. And I thought, man, if I go into biology, I think I might be able to transfer to Fresno State where they have more ample parking. And so I said, okay. So I took this last science class. And the teacher, you'll see in the poem, he was a kind of a funny guy. It's called Everything Twice. Biology was a set of marble-colored tables and gas spouts where we bloated up frogs. Science scared me, but I knew I had a chance if I bought the book early and read it with my lips moving, maybe twice, maybe with my roommate half listening. I tried chemistry, I tried astronomy, which was more like honest-to-goodness math than the star of Bethlehem shining down good news. I was never good at science, so at the beginning of spring, I leaned the elbows of my boredom on a piss-colored desk. But when the biology prof stumbled into the classroom, a wipe in his mouth, when he moved the chair out of the way and still bumped into it, I knew I had a chance. Our teacher was drunk. His bow tie was twisted up. A twig and a nest of hair grew from each ear. I looked at the skeleton in the corner and smiled. A breeze stirred the bones, which clacked on strings and wire. With the classroom splayed with sunlight and hope, the students sighed. A few pencils rolled to the floor, an easy grade for all. The prof slurred, "Man was never equal." He fumbled for the chalk at the blackboard. When he turned to us, the chalk dust clung to his face. For a moment, I don't think he knew where he was. He touched his bow tie. He stuck a finger into his hairy ear and repeated, "Man was never created equal." Took a step and stumbled into the chairs. Right there, I knew I didn't have to buy the book. He was already repeating himself. Right there, I looked out the window and sucked in the spring air of Fresno. Trees wagged blossoms and the like. One petal would sway, then another, sway after slight sway. A repetition that was endless and beautiful in the uniquely scientific world. Okay, that's enough of that book. It really is a funny book, but I also write children's literature, and as you might know, and some children's poetry as well. I'm going to read you just one poem, and this is called "The Ode to Pablo's Tennis Shoes." And you know, I always liked like worn clothes when I was a kid, and perhaps some of you have a favorite sweater, dress, pair of shoes, and I like new clothes, but there was that something about that old article of clothing that you really liked, and so this is about that. It's a very short, imagistic poem, and it's called Neighborhood Odes, and of course, there's no way to hide that it's actually influenced by Pablo Neruda, the great poet from Chile. He has a book called Elemental Odes, and then a second one called More Elemental Odes, or Second Elemental Odes. And then, not to be redundant, he has one called The Third Elemental Odes. But anyway, I only have one, so. Ode to Pablo's Tennis Shoes. They wait under Pablo's bed, a scuff of green at their tips from when he fell in the schoolyard. Pablo fell leaping for a football that sailed his way. But Pablo fell and got up, green on his shoes, with a football out of reach. Now it's night. Pablo was in bed listening to his mother laughing to the Mexican telenovelas on TV. His shoes, twin pets that snuggle his toes, are under his bed. He should have bathed, but he didn't. Dirt rolls from his palm. Blades of grass tumble from his hair. Pablo wants to be like his shoes, a little dirty from the road, a little worn from racing to the drinking fountain 100 times in one day. It takes water to make Pablo go and his shoes to get him there. He loves his shoes, cloth like a sail, rubber like a lifeboat on rough sea. Pablo is tired, sinking into his mattress. His eyes sting from grass and long words and books. He needs 8 hours of sleep to cool his shoes. The tongue's exhausted and hanging from... He needs 8 hours of sleep to cool his shoes. The tongue's hanging out, exhausted. One more poem from this little book called Neighborhood Odes, and it's Ode to the Mayor. And all of us, you know, if you have a brother or sister, there are days when you say, boy, I wish that person would disappear for good. It's called Sibling Rivalry. And we have a kid here going to that... that period in his life. Ode to the Mayor. Dear Mayor, my brother Danny chipped his tooth on the cracked sidewalk. His fault, really, because he was on the skateboard with his eyes closed and his fat mouth open. His front tooth is chipped, and now he sticks his tongue where his tooth was. He's making me mad. He's making my baby sister mad because she was the one missing a tooth. My fault because I was racing her around in the stroller and tipped her over, taking a corner. No cracked sidewalk there, just flat, smooth sidewalk. Dear Mayor, I'm writing you not about my sister, but about Danny. He's bothering everybody. He's on his board right now, and he's taunting three girls, his fat tongue wiggling like a worm from the chipped place in his mouth. It's embarrassing. No one likes us. Not even the dogs come by to wag their tails. Dear Mayor, have you seen Danny when you drive around town? He wears glasses. Sometimes he wears a T-shirt, and sometimes he doesn't. Brown face, sticky with ice cream. Mom cut his hair yesterday, and he's bald as a fist. Just look for a wagging tongue. Is there a law, Mr. Mayor, against a boy with glasses, sticky face, no hair, and a tongue between his teeth on a Saturday morning? Okay, I'm going to stop here. I want you guys to ask me a question. And before I go on, I'm going to just do the little Q&A right in the middle of this thing here. It's good to be here in Chicago. It's been about 8 years since I've been here. You have a question you'd like to ask this guy here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, dogs, you know. One of the greatest compliments I received was from, I was in Georgia about a month ago, and I was at a book signing. It was an educational group, a very nice teacher, and the teacher came up to me, "Please sign my book." I said, "Oh, no problem." He goes, and she's like beaming at me. I said, "Well, what's going on here?" And she says, "Well, you know, I like your poetry so much and your stories, and that I named my dog after you." So in Georgia, there's a dog named Soto. And I asked her, "Is he a dirty dog?" And he goes, "Very dirty." And so, you know, that's, but that reoccurs quite a bit, dogs. And I don't know what it is. I have an essay about that, too, about recognizing a dog. I was mentoring this Fuente project. It's sort of bridging, you know, you get a person who's a professional and a student, you work things out. I remember seeing a dog, you know, and the dog kept looking at him and goes, "Man, you think you're a success. You ain't a success." And his dog's sitting right there. I could tell it. "Go away, dog." But the dogs show up quite a bit. The fruit show up quite a bit. Okay, I'm going to read you, in fact, speaking of fruit, this is a poem called Oranges. And it's a poem that's well known. It's about a first girlfriend kind of thing. And I'm 13 years old. Candy bars cost a nickel back in the 60s. And this is, people think, well, this must be around the Peloponnesian Wars, huh? Wasn't it? And no, it was a nickel. You know, I remember penny candies, too. And it was remarked earlier that I'm one of the youngest poets in the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry. And the kids probably think, well, what do the other ones look like? Gosh, man, it was really stunningly old. The first time I went out with a girl, I was 13 years old, cold, and weighted down with two oranges in my jacket. It was December, frost cracking beneath my steps, my breath before me, then gone as I walked toward her house. The one whose porch light burned yellow, bright in day, in any weather. A dog barked at me until she came out pulling at her gloves, her face bright with makeup. I smiled, touched her shoulder, and led her down the street, across a used car lot, and a line of newly planted trees until we were standing before a drugstore. We entered the drugstore, the tiny bell bringing a sales lady down a narrow aisle of goods. I turned to the candies, teared like bleachers, and asked what she wanted. Light in her eyes, a smile starting at the corners of her mouth. I fingered a nickel in my pocket, and when she lifted a chocolate candy bar that cost a dime, I didn't say anything. I took the nickel from my pocket, then an orange, and set them both quietly on the counter. When I looked up, the lady's eyes met mine and held them, knowing very well what it was all about. Love, I mean. Outside the drugstore, a few cars hissing past,
fog hanging like old coats between the trees. I took my girl's hand in mine for 2 blocks, then released it to let her enwrap her chocolate. I peeled my orange that was so bright against the gray of December that from some distance someone might have thought I was making a fire in my hands. This is a poem from my grandmother and my abuelita. She's long gone, but she was something. It's called Magnets, and there's a reference to Cupid dolls. And in Fresno, we have little ferias that are really small. And so we entertain ourselves as best as we can in Fresno, in outlying communities as well. So Cupid doll has the little magnets in their heads. I click the plastic faces of Cupid dolls together. They want to kiss but can't. The magnets behind their heads have died out and wouldn't pull up iron filings from the loosest dirt, let alone show affection, smack lips, and clunk heads together and make my bashful nephew say, "Oh, that's for girls." They stare at each other shyly with hands behind their backs, black lash of youth, pink cheeks the first time. But it's over for them. The magnets have died out. I drink my coffee and think of old girlfriends, how we too clunked our heads together, kissed and clunked, until that pool of love stopped and we just looked at each other. Sometimes the magnets fall from our heads and settle in our hips. Beds are ruined this way. Books tumble from crowded shelves when couples clunk their waist together, with women looking at ceilings, men that lose hair on pillows, and then it's the other way around. But magnets die out. They grow heavy, these stones that could sharpen knives and bring faces together for one last kiss. For years, I thought iron lived forever, certainly longer than love. Now I have my doubts. The Cupid dolls set on starched doilies on my grandmother's television smile, but don't touch. The paint is flaking. Dust is a faint aura of loss. Grandmother loved her husband for 5 decades and still does. Poor grandpa, who is gone. They work side by side in the fields, box raisins, raise children in pairs. Now grandmother wants to die but doesn't know how. Her arms are frail. Her eyes of cataract can't hold her face. "Hijo, hijo," she says, and looks over my shoulder. It's blinding wisdom to see her on the edge of her couch. The magnet is in her feet, ready to gather up the earth. Thank you. I wish I could read you a dog poem, but this one's called The Philosophy of Dog and Man. And I read a bumper sticker. And bumper sticker just about a week ago said, let me get this right. "Dear God, let me be the person my dog thinks I am." if we could only be the person, our dogs may just love you. If we could only be that person, we would be courageous and wise and everything. I mean, we could open the refrigerator is amazing for dogs. He's doing it again. Isn't that amazing? that you pour water, you know, you turn on this faucet and the water appears in this bowl. My God, my master is just stupendous. I wish we could be, you know, what the people our dogs thought we are or are. Okay, let's see here. Ask me a question about books. Anybody? You guys did pay to get in here, didn't you? You should take advantage of that, man. Someone asked me, "What kind of car do you drive, Mr. Soto?" And I said, "A Buick." It's so interesting. It's a Buick Century, and 3 of its hubcaps, all plastic, are gone. I don't know what happened to them. Okay, this is a poem of from going back to junior college. Oh, where is your question? Yes, young lady here. "My favorite author. Gee, where do I begin? I don't know who to say is my favorite author, but Thomas Berger is one of my favorite authors. Do you know Thomas Berger? He wrote lots of books, but what's his name? He writes about people in lots of trouble. It's an adult novel called The Feud, if you really want to read what he's about. Little Big Man is his famous novel. But Thomas Berger. Actually, I put on my little, I have a little mom and pop website. It's not very fancy. I put my favorite books. But I read a lot of different writers, and if I mention them, they may make sense. John Galsworthy, there's Carson McCullers, I like a lot. I tried to read Hemingway again. I said, man, I don't think I like this stuff. You're told you're supposed to like it. And I went back and said, well, I don't know. Okay, this is called Pagan Life. And it's kind of like, you know, going back to Western civilization. So my Western civ teacher said, well, there's a lot of pagans in history. I said, all right, okay. And then I took history of religion, and they came up. In history of religion, I read that 3-foot pagans carried 5-foot spears, worshiped trees, and 100-pound pumpkins, and after week-long hunts, returned to the village. I'm going to skip a little bit here. This kind of. I licked my fingers and turned the page, looking for pictures. I found none of the pagans, only more words. The bell rang, and I left my class, 5'8", with no spear, no woman, no tree to stand under and chant, oh, blessed tree. I was 19. I dragged my loneliness like a dead cat to the levee. The water rushed black. The wind whipped the eucalyptus, that giraffe of trees. I bent my head over the water and shook Buddha-shaped tears into that ancient current. Tears floated by, the dead carcass of a suitcase, and overturned kitchen tables with spindly legs jutting above the surface. I cried for the fish and the fish's cousin, the one-eyed toad in the reeds. Then I picked up a stick, me the pagan, and chased a gopher into a hole. I grew small and powerful. As I walked, I became deliriously wild from carrying my 10-foot spear. My footprints left dents in the sandy ground, footprints that slowly shortened until they were only inches apart. By then, ants followed my march, beetles and termites, and one armadillo, a lockjawed disciple. By the time I reached Fresno, I was trouble for married and unmarried women. I was no bigger than a thumb. And my spear, oh yes, it tottered my arms and stirred the populace from their houses, wondrous girls climbing onto each other's shoulders for a glimpse of the thing that sanctified the air. I had a troubled mind during that period. These are really deadbeat poems. Our five senses. I'm not going to read the first part at all, but Aristotle came up with the notion that we live by our five senses. And of course, our five senses, taste, touch, sight, hearing, and there's another one I'm missing. Smell. There we go. And so taking Western Civ, I learned about that. Wow, gee, I learned something. And so I had a date, and I drove in my car, which was a 49 Plymouth car that was, it was a gas saver because I ended up pushing it a lot. I pushed my arms into an iron shirt, pulled together my five senses, and drove my date to a levee outside of Fresno. I peeked out the car window, and using my best line, I said, these stars died a million years ago. Her eyes lit up like a cat's when a car passed, and then died. I swallowed my fear and threw my face like a hatchet into her neck, bruised with hickeys that weren't mine. I employed two of my senses, taste and touch, and then pulled away from her. I said, Aristotle liked boys, but I like girls. And did you know that smell is a good way of knowing another person? A car passed
Once again, her eyes lit up and then went dead. She said, "Where did you learn this stuff, Gary?" I swallowed again and buried my face for more of the same. I pulled away, tongue exhausted from 13 laps around her neck. I answered, "I learned in junior college." I rolled down the car window and sucked in the spring air of Fresno. It stunk. We stood over the canal. Tires floated along the reedy bank. A five-eyed frog splashed in the chemical runoff. Not far away, rednecks peed into the water, adding to our misery. We drove away and parked under the whipping branches of a eucalyptus. I employed touch and taste and shrugged my shoulders when my dad called me by another dude's name. At 19, I could only take so much of the world. I guess the frog with five eyes was a living nightmare. That evening, I lived on my Aristotle and senses, but closed my eyes when I got back to her neck, bruised with hickeys, three of mine, and more boiling up under a boy's sloppy hunger. And I write children's books, too. And okay, ask me a question. It's good to be here in Chicago. I'm going to go to the Art Institute tomorrow. Yes, please. I think what brought me to poetry is that I felt like a poet ever since I was 10 years old. It was a calling, but I didn't do anything about it. I know, I have time, I'll just become a poet later on. But, I had a lot of trouble inside the house, outside the house, and trouble inside this house as well. So I thought, I'll just take my time. And but it wasn't until I was 20 that I really became very serious about this and decided to, shape up academically. So is that back there? Yes. My first poem was actually a very successful poem. It's actually in Poetry Magazine in this town. No, actually, Iowa Review, and then in Poetry. And I was 22 years old. 21 years old, and I was very, young. Just I really wanted to make this thing happen. But I think it has to do with obsession, that you really want to do it. You're obsessed to really want to create something that's never been created before, and that's your impulse. I think we saw that beautiful video, and I think the kids are creating something of a world for themselves on the page. Yes, please, here. My own personal time. I've been writing for close to 30 years now. I think when about 10 years ago, I was really on fire, writing quite a bit. And now I think there's someone asked, "Well, is inspiration part of it anymore?" Not really. It's I'm a professional writer. I've written lots of books, and I put I put myself into predicaments to write, get this novel done, just do it. And so I will do it. Get this poem, poetry collection done, just do it. And but about 10 years ago, I think I was doing some really interesting work, as in this poem called Hand Washing. Let's see what this is. I haven't read this poem in years, so let me. I would wash my hands after opening the refrigerator, after looking at the lunch meat and tomatoes, the blimp-shaped pickles in cloudy water. I would take out this food, then wash my hands before I flopped the bologna onto the whole wheat bread, and then wash them again before I pulled up a chair, using my knuckle only. I wrapped my sandwich in a paper bag and ate facing a wall lit with sunlight against feathery shadows. I nearly gave up going to mass. The chalice that was a smudge of tubercular disease, an instance that fortified pneumonia. I knew priests were really good people, but knew they shook hands with the dying. I worried about moisture nestled on the hairs of their knuckles. I considered this matter and considered the robes they swished across the altar. I knew they often coughed under the hands, then said, "Forgive our sins." After Mass, I used my shoulder to get into the washroom, then scald my hands with really hot water, and then climb upstairs to eat a donut. I didn't shake anyone's hand, just nodded my head and made my eyes kind of wide, my pupils filling with friendly light. I talked using only a little bit of my mouth. No telling where you were standing, a person had coughed and let disease float in the air.
I knew Catholics were coming around to talk in tongues, and I knew that weeping men were coming out of really large closets. One week, I noticed 3 out of 16 were coughing, and a week later, 7 out of 16 were coughing. I was never good at math, but knew that 8 was next. I was beginning to feel a rock-like scrape inside my throat. I stopped going and instead read the Bible by the window and considered the fly dead on the sill and the plagues marching from Egypt all the way to my hometown, Fresno. I like my wife to wash her hands and ask her often not to touch her teeth in public places. She went along and started pushing open doors using only her shoulder. I taught her how to pull a chair away from the table and to seal an envelope without touching the flap. She listened with her washed hands covering mine. She was nice to me and said nothing when she saw me washing not only my hands but my wrists and elbows, knobby points that touch public places, and maybe the edges of our dinner plates, an accident that could cause disease. If she asked, "What are you doing, Gary?" I would have looked up from the basin, curl of steam like incense, and answered, "I'm saving myself, and I'm saving you too, love." Okay, I'm out of that phase, okay? So don't worry about that. I'll shake your hands. How about another question? What's interesting is I think that poets do go into the self, and if you really, really, there was a confessional period in the contemporary writing, and I think you can go into the self and then outside of the self to sort of expose moments. How many have gone through a period of washing hands? Anybody out there? You have no fear. Very interesting. Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I will meet with you individually if you'd like to talk to me. And I really thank the Center for bringing me to Chicago. Thank you very much. Thank you.